Welcome to Food Talk. I'm Teresa.
And I'm Pat. We are with North Coast Food Web, working to build healthy communities in our region through food and agriculture.
Joining us today, I am so excited. We have Anne Berblinger from Gales Meadow Farm. Those of you who are Cannon Beach Farmers Market customers will know Gales Meadow Farm well. She's a wonderful farmer and a dear friend, and we're so happy you're here today. Anne, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us, Anne. Before we jump into our really interesting and exciting topic for today, perhaps you could share with our listeners just a little bit about your connection to the North Coast.
Well, you bet. In my former life, I was an economic development representative for the federal government, and I worked closely with all the coastal counties through numbers of economic dislocations and problems, and really, really grew to love Clatsop County and the great potential here that I see really coming about now. It's really fun. My husband and I started farming in the fall of 1999. That's when we talked to a fantastic, enthusiastic extension agent, and the next thing we knew, we were deeply in debt, having purchased a tractor.
And so it begins.
It's a slippery slope.
We started that fall planting winter greens and garlic. The next season, we were fortunate to get into the Hollywood Farmers Market in Northeast Portland.
It's a great market.
And to start selling to some restaurants, and the rest is history. Our arms were twisted to join the Cannon Beach Farmers Market in the year it started, which I don't remember, but
it was 2008.
2008, that sounds right.
I think it was, yeah.
And we loved it. It's a fun market. It's great for us. It takes about 20 minutes longer to get there than it does to get to Hollywood from our farm. And it's a much nicer drive. I should say that our farm is located at the foot of the Coast Range, but on the other side. Yeah. In Gales Creek, if you take Highway 6 to Tillamook, after you cross the summit going toward Portland, you will be following Gales Creek. It's a beautiful piece of
it's
land.
So beautiful.
An absolutely gorgeous location.
And Anne, is that you are a certified organic farm?
We are certified organic. We have only organic practices have been used on our farm since we purchased the land in 1991. Through the 90s, we leased it to a friend of ours who just did a great job. He moved on, and then it was up to us to take it over, which we happily did. The first year, we didn't attempt to get certification because we didn't expect to grow more than $5,000 worth of stuff. And sure, that came true.
Yeah.
But we were close enough that we realized we had to go through the process. We've worked with both Oregon Tilth and the Oregon Department of Agriculture as certifiers, and they're both absolutely great. And people who are not certified organic but follow organic practices should really look into becoming certified. Yeah, it's costly. Yes, there's a lot of paperwork involved, but you can then charge a premium for your product. And you can also be part of an absolutely wonderful community of certified organic producers.
Hmm. Which is really, and I think that the organic certification really links to what we're talking about today, which is seeds.
Absolutely.
And the importance of seeds to a small farm, the importance of seeds to home gardeners, and the challenges that small farms are facing. And you really specialize in a lot of heirloom varieties on your farm as well. And I think that there's just a lot of things to talk about with seeds. So I want to jump right into it because this is something dear to your heart.
It certainly is.
Tell our listeners why. Why should they care?
I often tell people, and it's true, that the reason Renee and I became farmers was because we could never grow every kind of thing we wanted to grow in our tiny home garden in Northeast Portland. And we now grow more than 300 varieties of vegetables and herbs, and we have a few fruits in there as well. We try new things every year. We take things off our list if they don't perform for us or if they aren't beautiful and delicious. But we could easily, if we had the time and the land and the resources, we certainly would have the enthusiasm to expand beyond that 300 or so. Being so interested in trying new things and fascinated by the varieties that you see within a single species of vegetable or herb. We had to get interested in seeds and how the seeds got to us. I made a little chart a few years ago that shows that the great majority of our seeds are grown in Oregon. About 30% of the varieties we grow are from seeds that we have saved ourselves.
Which is so great.
But then we also get seeds that originated or are actually grown in about 30 other countries, mostly about the 45th parallel, because day length is more important to vegetables than most of us have any awareness of. So we might have a lot of trouble with a seed that comes from Georgia or Texas, but we do just fine with seeds from Tuscany or the south of France, because those are on the same latitude as we are.
That is so fascinating.
So, I was, because I'm not a farmer, not as familiar with this topic, so I was doing a little bit of research, and there's some really, I think, fascinating information about why it's so important that we're saving seeds. Like, what does that mean to save seeds, and how do you do it, and how do you store them, and why is it important?
Yeah. Before I talk about the techniques, I'd like to go a little bit more into the reasons why we need to save seed. Good. And I hope you'll bear with me if I do a little history here.
It's great information, so listen up.
All right. For up until very recently, really after the year 2000, the seed industry for commodity products like corn and wheat and rice and soybeans was a very different set of companies from the companies that produced and sold garden seed. Now they're becoming way too often the same companies. I'll start with just a tiny background description of the commodity seed industry. That industry did not really exist before the 1920s or early 1930s. Prior to that, seed for commodity crops was either saved by farmers for replanting the following year, or it was produced by seed companies that were either local or very small regional. Those industries have been supported since the 1800s by public sector breeding programs at land-grant universities, which continually did breeding to improve the crops in various ways. Now, improvement is in the eye of the beholder. Improvement can be...
That's certainly true, yeah.
It can be more delicious, more productive, resistant to diseases and pests. It can also be breeding to improve shelf life,
yep. Yep.
Or prepare a crop for mechanical harvesting, or make something that can easily be transported thousands of miles without being at least visually damaged. And all the good things were done prior to the 1930s. And then a very good thing happened, with some unforeseen consequences. And that is the hybridization of corn, followed by hybridization and intense improvement of a lot of the other commodity crops.
And explain what hybridization means, because I think that really confuses a lot of people.
It absolutely does. And there's some deliberate confusion going on out there. For example, the Smithsonian Magazine, of all people, had a headline about how your kale is genetically modified. No, it is not. Not the way we use the word genetically modified, which means introducing a gene from another species into the DNA of a crop like corn.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen with kale, trust me, at least not yet. But hybridization is taking two varieties of the same species and introducing the pollen of one to the eggs, the seeds of another, and creating a crop that has the best qualities of both, or that has good qualities of both. And a lot of any seed that you see that's labeled F1, it's usually F1, there is F2, 3, and 4, but you don't see them in seed catalogs, is a mix of those two varieties.
Yeah.
If you save, you probably may have heard you can't save that seed. Yes, you can. You can replant it. But what you'll get is not what you grew. It'll be a reassortment of all the genetics of the two parents. And you might get a crazy, crazy range of things. And some of them may end up being very good. You can also, if you replant, if you select the ones you really like and replant them and reselect and replant them for 4 to 10 seasons, you may get a new open pollinated plant. And that process is called dehybridization. And I've done it. It's fun.
Yeah, and so then when we talk about open pollinated plants, those are plants that you can save seed from and the seed will come true.
Absolutely. Most of the time.
Most of the time.
Yeah. And I'll,
which is
I'll
part of the excitement.
The joys of farming, right?
I'll mention a little later on an issue that we have with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when hybrid corn was developed through joint efforts of many of the land-grant universities, there was a revolution in crop yields. In the early 1900s, corn was a dominant field crop, but yields were stagnant, and they stayed stagnant until hybrid corn was introduced in the 1930s. The yield was 20 bushels per acre. By 1970, 95% of the commodity corn was hybrid, and the yields were 70 bushels an acre, more than a tripling of yields.
So you can really understand the appeal. Yeah.
Yeah, for somebody trying to make
I'm
money.
I'm assuming
that
you
land.
Understand what yield. It means if that's how many bushels of corn you get by planting seed on an acre. By the mid-1990s, commodity corn was almost 100% hybrid, and the yield was 140 bushels per acre, a sevenfold increase.
Wow.
And 50% of that increase was attributed to breeding, and 50% to better agronomic processes like using better fertilizer, crop rotations, controlling weeds and pests better, and that kind of thing. So that process extended to the other commodity crops and yields. Nothing came through like corn, but there were multiple improvements in the yield of lots of other crops as a result of hybridization. But about starting, and this was all mostly work done by public sector breeding programs at land grant universities. But about in the early 1960s, private sector companies started doing their own breeding. Between 1960 and 1990, the amount of resources put into private sector breeding increased by well over 100%. But guess what? If a product is bred by a private company, it's a secret, and they're not going to share it with you, and nobody else can do it. Where breeding done by land grant universities was like open source software.
Yeah.
Anybody could do it.
And that is a huge difference.
And then later on, unfortunately, some public sector breeding companies contracted so that their smart people were producing seeds that would then be licensed by private companies. So it was a chink in the armor of the open source program in plant breeding. but even so, there were not official patent-type protections on the products of breeding until the 1980s. The first living thing to be patented was a genetically engineered bacteria. That happened in 1980. And then in the late 80s, there was a whole series of Supreme Court decisions that allowed patents on all kinds of living material, plants and animals both, which meant that seeds were not free anymore. They were not liberated. They were not open to everybody. It was not an open source system anymore. Then, after World War II, and I'm sure most of the people listening to this understand that the munitions companies had to find something else to do because we didn't need all that weapons stuff anymore. And many of them segued into the production of fossil fuel-based fertilizers and fossil fuel-based pesticides of various kinds. Those companies, the chemical companies, not the companies that had been breeding seeds, started to get interested then in genetically modifying seeds so that if you planted their seeds, you would have to use their products to grow the seed properly. If you bought Roundup Ready corn, you needed to buy Roundup to kill your weeds. So that's all a little bit of background of the commodity seed industry.
So it just in saying that, I think we need to pause briefly and let you know that you are listening to KMUN 91.9 FM and KTCB Tillamook 89.5 FM. We are streaming at coastradio.org, and you can listen on the mobile device of your choice using the TuneIn app. And we are talking to Ann Berbliger of Gales Meadow Farm in Gales Creek about seeds and the challenges of industrial seed to farmers. So, Ann, let us know what's going on.
The garden seed industry actually started much earlier than the commodity seed industry. It was started by some wonderful people, the Shakers, who grew beautiful crops and sold them. And then they started to grow and sell packaged seeds with instructions planted on the package for...
When was that? When did that start?
That was in the...
It's like the 1800s or... I'm trying to think, when would seed...
They started as early as 1790.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And if you look at some of the old pictures, if you Google Shaker seeds and look at the pictures, you will see a few varieties that we still grow and love today.
Wow.
Yeah. later, lots of other companies got into it. And then the industry split kind of between companies that raise seed, farms that raise seed, and companies that sold seed. And that has the potential for issues, but it's not necessarily an issue. About 2004, the large companies which produce GMO seeds and chemicals for industrial type farming suddenly developed an interest in garden seed. And they started to buy up both the producers of seeds and the companies that sold seed. There is a graphic, and I'm not going to give you the link, but it will be on the KMUN website.
It's a fascinating graphic.
We'll put it on the North Coast Food Web's Food Talk website, and we'll also put it on our Facebook page, North Coast Food Web's Facebook page. It's really interesting. It's very brief, but it's a cool animation that shows you the consolidation of the seed industry. It's kind of terrifying.
Yeah.
Kind of terrifying. When you realize the loss of diversity. Mm-hmm. In those businesses, and then the challenge of availability and who you're buying your seed from.
Yeah, 12 years ago, you could not buy garden seed that was owned by Monsanto or Syngenta. Now, very popular and very good, particularly hybrid varieties, are actually all produced by them, and they get some money if you buy those. I'll just mention Big Boy, Early Girl, and Sweet 1 Million Tomatoes, three very, very popular kinds.
Yeah, those were heartbreakers.
Yeah. Gold Rush beans, Eureka green beans. And some of these, by the way, beans are not hybrids. You don't get hybrid beans.
Yeah, and it's sad that some of the beautiful open-pollinated varieties are going that way too. So challenging for people, I think, to understand why is this an impact? How does this affect you as a farmer? What are the challenges for you?
Well, one early effect was that a lot of the very popular hybrids and even some open pollinated varieties were withdrawn from production.
Yeah.
When the large companies bought it, they didn't want the diversity that was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just eliminated a lot of varieties that you used to be able to get pretty easily. some of the open pollinated varieties of those, I'll mention our two favorite Romano beans, Musica and our Golden Romano, returned to the commercial seed trade thanks to Seed Savers, because Seed Savers can save open-pollinated, non-hybrid seed. And then if somebody wants it, they can just grow it for a couple of years, and then they'll have enough seed to return to commercial production. The hybrids are not going to come back.
Yeah.
But what's even worse, and this hasn't affected gardeners yet, but it does affect farmers who grow large quantities of individual crops is they are seeing implicit contracts printed on the seed packages that say, organic farmers, when you open your bag of big beef tomato or Speedway cucumber, please carefully read the licensing agreement you are making with Monsanto Sementis by simply opening the bag. And the agreement is that you won't save seed and you won't sell seed, even though it may not be patent or patentable because it's an old variety that's been around a long time. By getting the seed from them, you're signing an agreement. Could they enforce it? Maybe not. Could they try? Maybe they would.
It has a very chilling effect, I think, when you open a seed packet and read that.
Yeah.
That's why you have to keep buying new seeds.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a brilliant business model. I have to give them that, you know, because that's a guaranteed income. But it is really challenging, I think, as a farmer or a gardener, when you want to grow a certain plant or you want to save seed from a certain plant and it's patented and you're legally prevented. I mean, it's illegal for you to save seed and grow that seed on. Mm-hmm. And I think that that really flies it's in the face of just generations, thousands of years of people saving seed, selecting seed, and sharing seed. And there are some amazing organizations out there. I know Seed Savers Exchange, which is based in Iowa, I believe, is a great place where they've been really preserving a lot of varieties and working with seed savers all over the country to bring back varieties that, you know, theoretically have been lost or to find new varieties. There's some really good stuff out there. There's reason for optimism, but it's a challenge still.
Well, let me just mention a few of the challenges. First of all, small seed companies, many of which offered very high quality seed up through the 90s and into the 2000s, have no leverage in the marketplace anymore. So there's a quote in the latest edition of Growing Organic Vegetables by Steve Solomon: the gardener gets the sweepings from the seed room floor. And so if you're buying from companies that don't grow their own seed, your chances of getting low quality seed are good. Yeah. Another issue is that many old open pollinated varieties have not been carefully stewarded. So they just aren't as good. They aren't reliable. Some of their good qualities have disappeared. But many of these have been replaced by newer open pollinated varieties, very, very often the product of the land grant universities that are still involved in growing seed for gardeners and being part of the open source system. I want to mention Oregon State University.
Oregon State has a great program for that. They really do.
Absolutely. And then there are independent breeders around, and we've got a bunch of them in Oregon who are just absolute heroes.
I know. We are so fortunate.
I was going to say, Anne, so if our listeners want some information about who those great folks are, how can they perhaps get a hold of you or get that information?
Well, let me just mention a few names. I call these people the seed industry heroes. And let me also say, read your seed catalog. If the seed company grows its own seed, that's wonderful. If they grow a lot of their own seed but also get seed from other small seed growers, that's wonderful too. So pay attention. If they don't say anything about growing their own seed, ask them questions. If they don't grow their own seed, but they have their own test garden, so they're continually getting personal experience of the quality of seeds, that's good too. That Johnny's Seed in Maine is a good example of that. But I do want to mention some of our local seed heroes, and you can get seed from these people. Frank Morton at Wild Garden Seed in Philomath, Oregon,
such a cool guy,
is a national treasure, a brilliant, brilliant plant breeder. And the quality of seed that you can get from Wild Garden Seed, both a printed catalog and a website, is great. Adaptive Seeds, a newer company near Sweet Home, Oregon, they do a little breeding, but mainly their forte is they have gathered seeds from all over the world, brought them into the U.S. legally, bless their hearts, and are growing them out and offering them. And their website and their catalog are just a total feast, just absolutely amazing. Victory Seeds in Molalla, Oregon, has preserved hundreds of varieties of historical and heirloom tomato seeds. They don't grow all their own seeds, but they do grow all their own tomato seeds, and they're another wonderful, wonderful source.
So we have people right here in Oregon that are doing some really wonderful, wonderful mm-hmm. work in saving seeds.
They are, and I know that people may have questions, more questions for Anne. She is a font of information. We really want to get you back to the coast sometime to talk more about this, because I think it's a huge topic, and we are sadly running out of time today. But what we'll do on our North Coast Food Web Facebook page is we'll post a link to Anne's farm, and we'll put her her contact information there, so that and if you want to get Anne's contact information, you can always email us at info@northcoastfoodweb.org, and we will hook you up with her if you have more questions or wanting more information from her.
It's a fascinating topic.
It really is. I just want to also say you could come out and talk to Anne. She and her farm are going to be at Spring Into Gardening this year on April 11th. We're super excited to hear that. That's the Master Gardeners big spring garden event at the Clatsop County Fairgrounds, April 11th. Save that date. North Coast Food Web is going to be heavily involved. Lots of food tasting. It's all about food. We're going to be doing Meet Your Farmer there.
Food,
it's going to be a really good day. So definitely put that on your calendar. Another date I really want you to put on your calendar is March 14th. That is the third in our food film festival for North Coast Food Web's Raising
Tortilla
the Dough.
Tortilla Soup.
We're going to be showing the film Tortilla Soup at the Columbian. The film starts at 9:30. You can swing by our new building for an open house starting from 5 to 8. During Art Walk, and we're going to be serving up some great snacks and showing you where our new kitchen space is going to slowly evolve. So
ever
join
evolving.
Us for that. Information about those things on our website, northcoastfoodweb.org, and also on our Facebook page. And I think that's all the upcoming stuff we've got going on right now. Do you want to say some thank yous, Pat?
I think that has us covered for the next 30 days or so. So thanks to Anne for joining us today. Really, really interesting topic. Can't wait to hear more about it. Thanks to our engineer, Marianne, to Luke and Katie for our theme song. And thanks for joining us today for fresh conversations about food on the North Coast.
Do you want to say a few final words, Anne?
Oh, sure. I'm giving you an estimate now, but I think we'll have 40 to 50 of our 300 varieties available as starts at the Spring Into Gardening event.
And wonderful. They grow beautiful plants. You want these in your garden.
So something really great to look forward to at the Spring Garden Show.
Absolutely.
April 11th.
Yep. So, and this
at
show.
At the fairgrounds.
yes, it's out of the Clatsop County Fairgrounds.